You're listening to Political Animals, Bowling Green's premier political radio talk show, and your personal 1,000-watt megaphone for liberty. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us at 419-372-8810 or toll free at 888-7-WBGU-FM. You can also reach us on the web at politicalanimals@WBGUFM.com. And now, here's your host, the three guys who are proudly fair and biased, Jay Lafayette, Peter Jaworski, and Terrence Watson. I don't care much of violent times,
but I care about love, and I care about truth.
The ideas and opinions expressed on Political Animals are those of the hosts and do not necessarily represent those of WBGU-FM, the Department of Telecommunications, the School of Communication Studies, or Bowling Green State University.
You are listening to WBGU 88.1 FM in Bowling Green, Ohio, broadcasting from the campus of Bowling Green State University. This is Political Animals, normally hosted by Jay Lafayette, Peter Jaworski, and Terrence Watkins.
Watson.
I am DJ Hazmat, but for such a serious program, you can just call me Andrew. And joining me now are the co-hosts of the show. I'll be filling in as board op since, unfortunately, Mr. Lafayette could not be with us today.
Well, Andrew, I might too.
All right. Hey, we're on. Good.
Hey, okay, Andrew, thanks very much for running the board. We appreciate it. Jay is in beautiful New Orleans. He might be calling in from the French Quarter. We have a packed show for the listeners today. Actually, in the studio, we have Dr. John Lewis. He's a visiting scholar at the Social Philosophy and Policy Center. John, maybe you could introduce yourself to the listeners.
Hello, I'm John Lewis, and I'm a visiting scholar at the Social Philosophy and Policy Center. I'm up here for a year on a fellowship to do some research and writing on a book, and I very much appreciate being here in general and in particular today.
And you are also the assistant professor of history at Ashland University, is that right?
Well, yes, I've been associate professor of history there, and my wife and I moved to Durham, North Carolina, which is where I'll be next year, a position to be announced at a later time.
And you're also the contributing editor of the journal The Objective Standard, and is this article out in the current issue, No Substitute for Victory, The Defeat of Islamic Totalitarianism?
Actually, the journal is The Objective Standard. It's available on the web. You can see their website at www.theobjectivestandard.com. And this article, No Substitute for Victory, came out several issues ago. It's a little over a year old, I think, but it's available for free on the web. Normally you have to have a subscription to get stuff, but the editor put this out.
So we'll get a chance to speak with Dr. Lewis in the second hour of the show as well as in the first hour, but we're going to focus the first hour on election fever. Those of you in Ohio, everybody should be aware that the primaries are tomorrow, so we'll spend a lot of time talking about the Republican and the Democratic primaries. I think we'll spend a lot of time talking about Barack Obama in particular and John McCain. And our guest at the top of the hour will be Matt Welch. He's the editor-in-chief of my favorite magazine, Reason Magazine. He's also the author of McCain, The Myth of a Maverick. I don't think Matt Welch is a big fan of John McCain, so I think we'll hear some negative talk about John McCain today.
Joss, can I propose a new feature if we're going to talk about Barack Obama? And I call it the Obama Messiah Watch. So we're going to determine how many miracles he's... I mean, apparently women are fainting at his... That's pretty cool. I don't have the power to make women faint. I only wish that I did. So we got to see how long it'll be till he turns loaves into fishes and... or not turns loaves into fishes, but feeds the multitude and things like that. And eventually he'll probably raise the dead. I think judging by the tone of some of the luminous editorials in his favor that I've seen lately.
I saw the ritualistic blowing of the nose recently, and that it elicited great cheers and perhaps some unconsciousness from the crowd.
I read an article recently that talked about the Obamamania, or Obamania, however it's pronounced. You're right, Terrence. Women are swooning, they are fainting, and they're screaming as though this was 1964 Beatles mania. Yeah. 16,000 people came out to see Obama. He's sort of generating a reaction that I'm surprised by.
He's getting over the standard apathy that people have characterized the American public as having for some time, I think. People seem to be really excited about politics again. And yeah, that's good.
But the kinds of things that they're excited about when it comes to Obama is not stuff of substance.
Well,
we can have a discussion about this if you want, but it seems to me like what they're excited about is the fact that this guy can give a speech. It's the same kind of excitement that like Mike Huckabee might generate, except Obama's younger, he's handsome, he's very exciting.
I think Huckabee's kind of handsome, but...
Obama is a tremendous orator, you know, and I it's interesting to note where he really came from. Nobody heard of him a few years ago, and he came out of a speech he gave at the last Democratic National Convention, if I recall, which was the first time we'd heard in this country in a long time a really forthright, unapologetic liberal speech. And he's bringing to mind, I think, John Kennedy, and I recall, you know, I was born in 1955. Kennedy became president when I was a young boy, and there was a certain mystique, I mean, the aura that this guy had. I actually wanted to wear suit jackets that looked like John Kennedy. And I think there's some of that today. I think that's a good part of his, it's not substance, it's a certain liberal mystique that's unapologetic.
I hear comparisons to Bobby Kennedy. Not John Kennedy, but Bobby Kennedy.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, I hang out on a lot of left-wing message boards and things like that and talk to a lot of liberals, and they say, I mean, they're often ashamed to call themselves liberals. They'll call themselves progressives or something like that. And, I mean, it is interesting that he's unapologetically liberal as he is. That in itself is, I think, a difference from the way that American political discourse has gone on, at least from my point of view.
Yep, and the kinds of things that they're saying about Obama is precisely the kind of stuff that I don't like hearing in political elections, namely that he has the audacity of hope or something like that.
I don't even know what that means. That was the title of his book.
That's right, and he brings hope and good cheer and all this other stuff, and none of it has to do with the kind of policy issues that I'd like to see covered.
I mean, we've talked about this before, right? I mean, you've asserted that you would have a preference for voting for, like, piles of policies rather than people.
That's right.
Right, and you know, part of me, the sort of intellectual part of me, thinks that, yeah, maybe that would be better if we could just focus on, like, packages of policies, right, rather than the face that is put onto those policies. You know, but that's not the way the world works. People are going to go for the person that makes them feel good, maybe not the person that has the best policies, although in this case it could be that he does have the best policies and the right face to go with it.
Well, the United States is a special case, isn't it? I mean, the president combines both the head of state and the head of government. He is both of those things. If you compare that with Canada and with Britain, the head of state is the queen, and the head of the government is the prime minister.
Right. Lots of Canadians don't even know that, actually.
And the symbolic value is wrapped up in the head of state.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole soap opera thing, I mean, we care about what the queen is wearing, what the queen is doing, and things of that sort. And that's wrapped up in the head of state and not the head of the government. Or at least that's how I would prefer for it to be. We should focus a lot less when it comes to the head of government on these kind of flowery issues, like whether or not the guy is wearing the right color tie with the right color suit, and whether or not he's had a date in the last 3 months or not, or whatever.
You know, it's interesting, though, that even in Canada, people don't really look to the Queen as, you know, like I said, most Canadians don't even know the Queen is the head of state. They do tend to view the Prime Minister in a way that's similar to the way Americans view the President. I think it's kind of inevitable. I mean, the Canadians are more familiar with the face of the Prime Minister than they are familiar with the face of the Queen. So, I mean, I guess it comes down to whoever they see on the news, that's the face that they're going to put on the policies that are being proposed. And
I might interject here, we have Jerry Nichols.
Oh, okay.
Great.
On the phone.
Awesome.
Here. Hold on.
Let's put him on.
A moment.
Can Jerry hear us right now?
Press
it again. Jerry, are you there?
Hold on a second.
Jerry?
Yes, hi.
Oh, hey, okay, let me introduce you. Jerry Nichols is one of the top three political minds in Canada. If I keep on repeating that, it becomes truer and truer with every passing show. He's also the senior associate for the Institute for Liberal Studies, as well as a senior associate with the Democracy Institute. Jerry comes on the show every week to talk about Canada. What's new and what's happening in Canada as of late, Jerry?
Well, I remember a couple weeks ago I told you nothing was going on, that it was really boring. Well, it changed. Now we have a really juicy scandal on the books. It's got everybody all excited up here.
Is this the Chuck Cadman? Is that what you're referring to?
Chuck Cadman. It's a scandal that involves dying MPs, million-dollar life insurance policies, and secret tape recording. It's all very exciting. Essentially what happened was, it goes back 3 years ago to 2005, when the Liberals were still in power. They held a minority government, and the Conservatives at that time were in the opposition, and they wanted to topple the government in May of 2005. They wanted to bring down the government, but the vote in the House of Commons was deadlocked. It was basically a dead heat, and the deciding vote belonged to an independent member of parliament named Chuck Cadman. Now, Chuck Cadman happened to be dying of cancer at the time. He was quite ill. And there's a new book has come out just recently, just last week, which alleges that representatives from the Conservative Party offered Chuck Cadman $1 million life insurance policy if he were to vote with the Conservatives and topple the government. In other words, that he shouldn't have to worry about, you know, losing his job as an MP should the House fall, because, you know, he would have this life insurance policy which would take care of his family.
So they tried to bribe him, basically.
Essentially, they said the allegation is that the Conservative Party tried to bribe this member of parliament, which, of course, is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if it was true, some conservative people would probably have to go to jail. And to add a little bit of interest to the story, the Conservative Party has denied this. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has denied offering him any kind of bribe or anything like that. But to add a little bit of interest, the guy who wrote the book, which contains the allegation, released an audio tape of the Prime Minister talking to him. At that time, he was still leader of the opposition, acknowledging that some of his representatives were meeting Chuck Cadman and that there was some kind of financial offer being made. Now, he doesn't say it's a million-dollar life insurance policy. It's kind of vague what he's talking about. But that only added, you know, fuel to the fire of scandal mongers. And, of course, the Liberals and the NDP and the other people in the opposition are having a field day with this. Now, another little twist is that the guy's wife, his surviving wife, is running for the Conservative Party in the next election. She's the one who she's also said that, yes, he did say that the Conservatives did offer him $1 million life insurance policy. And his daughters come forward and said that, yes, on his deathbed, he was really angry about this, that the Conservatives had done this. Now, Chuck Cadman himself, when he was alive, never made any mention of it. Like, he basically did some TV interviews when the vote was coming down, and he never mentioned it at the time. So there's all kinds of questions about this. And the latest little twist today is that the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is threatening to sue the leader of the opposition, Stéphane Dion, for libel, unless he apologizes for making some of the accusations he's made in writing and on his website and other places about this whole mess. So it's really getting exciting here if you like scandals.
So, Jerry, I want to put this in. I mean, it's hard to find equivalent American terms, but for the American listeners, I guess it would be kind of like, what, George Bush threatening to sue Nancy Pelosi for defamation or something. I mean, I know that's not the best example, but it would be something similar to that.
Essentially, what the opposition has repeated, or what Stephen Harper is saying, is that they're actually accusing him of breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
They're defaming him, saying that he may have participated in some kind of legal activity. Yeah, so it would be like the President of the United States threatening a congressional leader with a defamation suit. Now, it's never happened here before. It probably never happened in the United States either. Certainly, it has never happened for anything for any kind of question before the House of Commons. So it's kind of a groundbreaking event that's taking place here.
I was going to say, it sounds a little bit sloppy on the part of Stéphane Dion. I mean, you have immunity if you defame somebody or libel somebody in the House of Commons. So what, did Stéphane Dion say something outside of the House? Did he report something to reporters? Did he make reference to this scandal outside of the House of Commons?
Well, apparently they made some kind of reference to it on the Liberal Party website. I'm not quite sure what they said, but apparently it was, at least according to the Prime Minister and according to the Conservative government, that it was defamatory, that they were linking Stephen Harper to this whole sordid affair.
Jerry, we have Dr. John Lewis in the studio. He wants to ask you a question.
Yeah, just a point of clarification. He's threatened to sue at this point, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, he's demanding that the Liberal leader issue an apology. They take the stuff down from their website and all that kind of stuff. They're basically asking the Liberal leader to back down. And as of today, he says he isn't going to do it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, the threat to sue is itself pretty problematic, isn't it?
Well, he's saying, the Prime Minister is saying, unless you do these things, unless you apologize, unless you make it right, then we will sue you, then we will take you to court.
Hmm. Yeah, what I'm saying is more broadly for the Prime Minister even make such a threat.
Oh, yes, yes. It's never happened before, as far as I know. It's the first time that, certainly anything before the House of Commons, it's the first time that there's been this kind of legal threat in the air.
Now, I mean, I guess it's fair to say that it's harder, the law considers it more difficult to defame a politician than someone who's just a private individual, right? Like, the burden is a lot higher. I mean, would it be difficult for the Prime Minister to actually, if he did launch a defamation lawsuit, would it be difficult for him to win, if that's the route that he pursued?
Well, yeah, it's sort of, you know, venturing outside my area of expertise is not libel law, but I can tell you from my own experience, I had something very similar when I was working for an organization called the National Citizens Coalition. A liberal cabinet minister was on the air when it was on a television show in which he accused our organization of illegal lobbying, which was not true. And I shot off a letter to him saying, you know, you better apologize, you know, sort of same thing as Harper did, and he backed off.
Mm-hmm.
He did apologize. He got up in the House of Commons and did apologize. So I think, and I'm sure the Prime Minister consulted with his lawyers on this, and I'm sure he's on firm ground legally, because I don't see why he's a very smart guy. I don't see why he would do this unless he had his ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he might have some good grounds here.
Yeah, I guess the latest thing that I heard is that the widow of the MP, who the bribe was allegedly offered to, it now says that the Prime Minister himself had no knowledge of this. Or is that correct? Is that the latest?
Yeah, that's her story now. Again, this is a really odd story. Why would she be running for the Conservative Party if she was angry about the fact that the leader of the party tried to bribe her husband?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's her latest thing, that she thinks it was some unnamed Conservative officials who were responsible for this, and that the Prime Minister had nothing to do with it, and that, you know, he was completely innocent.
I'm sorry, Jerry, we've got to interrupt you for just a moment so that we can go on and give a few announcements. We'll be right back in just a few moments.
You're listening to Political Animals, Bowling Green's premier political radio talk show, and your personal 1,000-watt megaphone for liberty. If you want to be part of the conversation, call us at 419-372-8810 or toll-free at 888-7-WBGU-FM. You can also reach us on the web at politicalanimals@WBGUFM.com.
You are listening to Political Animals right here on WBGU 88.1 FM. Going to return you now to Peter Jaworski and Terrence Watson and our multiple guests in the studio and on the phone.
Wow, that was an extraordinarily long and painful weather advisory.
I'm sorry about that. Had to be done.
But there are primaries tomorrow, so I guess maybe this will dampen the amount of people who show up and vote for.
Well, I sure hope not. Just be careful out there.
Hey, Jerry?
A lot of ice coming your way.
Yeah, apparently. And because of the lengthy weather advisory, we're going to have to let you go because we have Matt Welch hanging on the line. So maybe you want to say some final words about the Chuck Cadman controversy?
Well, I guess the only thing to say finally about it is that this is going to probably hurt the conservatives, even if there's nothing to it, because they sort of built a reputation as being, you know, squeaky clean and free from scandal, where the liberals were supposed to be the scandal-ridden party. So I think, politically speaking, I think this is going to hurt them unless they can really turn it around somehow.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Jerry.
Okay.
Take care. All right. And on the line, we have Matt Welch. He's the editor-in-chief of, like I said before, my favorite magazine in the world, Reason Magazine. He's also the author of McCain, The Myth of a Maverick. Matt, are you with us?
I sure am. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you bet. Hey, thanks for calling in. Thanks for joining us here on Political Animals. So I guess right off the top, let's talk about John McCain, and let's talk about the contents of your book. When you say The Myth of a Maverick, that's the subtitle of your book, what do you mean? Isn't he mavericky?
He is mavericky, but so many elements of mythology have crept up around his maverickdom that to have a rational discussion about what his actual ideas are, what his political ideology, what kind of president he would make, the first thing that you have to do is take a machete to all of the layers of mythology that have grown up around him. He's a maverick in much the same way as your sort of Tom Cruise character was in Top Gun, if you recall that. Just sort of a pop-off fly boy from a military family and a chip on his shoulder and short man's disease and all that kind of stuff. As a politician, his maverickness is probably best just summed up in that he's military first, political party second, or I should say country first, political party second, and that plus some of the strains of his ideology lead him to places that are not traditionally Republican, which I'll get to in a second. But probably the biggest miss before you go anywhere is that he's some kind of straight talker, which is the way that he basically runs on. That's that and his Vietnam record and his sort of sense of gravitas when it comes to foreign policy is the sort of justification of his campaign. And he's not a straight talker. He's a blunt talker, and there's a huge difference that escaped the attention of mostly campaign journalists who I think have given him more favorable coverage than any Republican national politician in the last 25 years. I mean, I really can't think of anyone, not even Ronald Reagan, got as much positive press as John McCain has throughout his career.
So, Matt, maybe you could give us some examples of what you mean when you say he's not a straight talker, he's a blunt talker. First of all, what's the difference between being a straight talker and being a blunt talker? And then can you give us an example or two of when John McCain was being a blunt talker, but everybody interpreted him as being a straight talker?
Sure. A blunt talker is a guy who, in his first, half a minute of meeting you, is going to volunteer the information that he cheated on his first wife. This is not what you expect from politicians, and he's going to do it without any of his media minders around him saying, "Oh no, you can't say that." He sort of shoots off the cuff whatever comes up through his head, and it is incredibly refreshing. And it's one of many reasons why journalists like him. He started this approach in the wake of the Charles Keating scandal in 20 years ago in Arizona, which is, of course, horrendously complicated, but basically he just did some mild favors for a huge campaign contributor and then was called on the carpet in the Senate Ethics Committee. And it was the low point of his life, not just his career. He describes it as worse than Vietnam because people were questioning his honor. And what he did during that is very interesting. He held a press conference and just stood there until they ran out of questions. It took like 2.5 hours, 3 hours or something like that in Arizona. And lo and behold, he got positive press, because what happens when you give journalists unfettered access, well, they tend to like you a little bit more. And it also helps if you are a naturally charismatic personality and you talk dirt on your own self and you're a legitimate war hero. So in these senses, he's a very blunt talker. Straight talker is a different thing altogether. For instance, that sort of terrible New York Times story that came out a couple of weeks ago dulled its own point by making a very unsourced allegation about a possible affair he might have had with a telecom lobbyist. His responses to that have been filled with anything but straight talk. The lobbyist was working for a head of a cable company over on the East Coast here called Paxson Communications, and McCain said, "I've never met with the head of that cable company." Well, he flew on the guy's plane. The guy held a fundraiser for him, and the guy himself said, "Of course I met with him, and we discussed the regulatory issue in question." McCain frequently, in his denials of various allegations, will go way too far and say things like, "Oh, I've never done any favors for any campaign contributor or lobbyist." This is belied by his own writing. I mean, my book is based basically on reading his books closely more than any other source, and he tells these stories on himself, but most political reporters don't actually go through and read and see that he's contradicting himself constantly in the ebb and flow of the campaign trail.
So, Matt, would you say that John McCain lies, or that he just sort of puts his foot in his mouth, if I can make a distinction there?
He's done a combination of both. He will look you in the eye and tell you stuff that he knows is not true. And again, this is stuff that he's admitted. Classic cases in the 2000 presidential campaign in South Carolina, he came out and gave pretty strong statements against the Confederate flag flying above the state capitol dome there. back then. And then he caught all kinds of bloody hell from it, from conservatives and from his own campaign handlers. And the very next day, he came out and sort of theatrically unfolded this piece of paper in his coat and read the statement, "I think this is a state's rights issue that should be left to the state." And what's interesting about that is that, A, he did this, and B, he said later, "I did that in such a way to telegraph to reporters that my heart wasn't really in it, that I as if I was being held hostage, and that I still basically, you know, agreed with the sentiment." So it's an interesting, like, double lie going on there. And then he, of course, confesses it later, and people give him credit for being a straight talker. It's kind of a he's kind of like the alcoholic who disarms people by saying he's an alcoholic.
He turns his lemons into lemonade. Maybe that would be, you know, charitable.
Yes, but I mean, I should stress that I don't think that he's any bigger of a dissembler or a, you know, a liar than any other politician. However, he is running on this "I'm more honest than anybody else" type of campaign, and so that make some interesting suggestions of what his motivations are or what he even thinks about his own sense of propriety and honor.
So I know one issue that McCain seems to have changed his mind on that drives conservatives nuts is the immigration question, right? Yep. He seems much less open to open immigration now than he used to be. Would you say, like, there's been a genuine shift in his position, or is it just political expediency in the way that we've been describing?
I'll give the benefit of the doubt here. It's basically both. He almost lost because of immigration. A lot of people spun it that his bad fortunes in 2007 were because of his support for the surge, and that's just nonsense. I mean, he was running for a Republican primary. You know, everyone was in a contest to outsurge one another. But it was his co-sponsorship of immigration reform that really built up all of this anger. And he listened to it, and he said, okay. I mean, he actually had some quotes like, "Well, if they want a damn fence, I guess I'll just build it, whatever." His heart is not in it. His heart on this issue is very consistent with a lot of his feelings about the conservative base. He's never been among them. Probably the biggest single myth besides the straight talk when it comes to John McCain is that he's somehow some kind of man of the people. That's actually the name of a biography that was written about him by a Rolling Stone journalist. In fact, he's been his whole life, for good and for ill, an elitist, a total elitist in every sense of the term. He grew up, born and raised basically all around the Beltway, went to, you know, elite private schools. Father was a four-star admiral in the Navy. Grandfather was a four-star admiral in the Navy. You know, he grew up with senators and generals and politicians at his breakfast table, literally on Capitol Hill. And when he came to politics, which he only did, I mean, he bought his house in the congressional district that he lived in on the day that he found out that the incumbent Republican congressman was retiring. He had absolutely no history of working with political parties and party building and all of this. And as a result, and his, you know, his natural affinity is for people who are like national journalists and historians and fellow politicians, he has no comfort level with grassroots conservatives at all. And they don't, in fact, even know him. If you go to Phoenix and you ask around, like, you know, somebody who's worked in GOP politics there for 25 years, they might have met him twice. He's just not there. So he has this sense that those people are yahoos. And part of his opposition to immigration reform, or opposition to sort of a anti-immigration or anti-illegal immigration sentiment, is based on the idea that he's afraid that America is becoming, and especially conservatives, are becoming more ugly, more xenophobic. That is that, and the fact that there is a system, you know, obviously that doesn't work. And McCain is geared very much like an editorial writer of a newspaper. You know, he says, "See problem, fix problem," which is one reason why he editorial boards love to endorse.
So I get the sense that there's kind of actually a sea change happening amongst grassroots conservatives. I listen to Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin on a regular basis, and I know prior to the New York Times article coming out, they were both, including Glenn Beck and all of the conservative radio talk show hosts, they were slagging John McCain. Ann Coulter said she would vote for Hillary Clinton over John McCain. But then this New York Times article comes out, and all of a sudden what you see is all these conservatives sort of lining up behind McCain. Is that what accounts for the sea change? Do you see the same change happening? I was listening to Rush Limbaugh earlier today, and Rush Limbaugh says, yeah, we should all just sort of, you know, get behind John McCain in spite of our worries and in spite of the kind of tensions that we have with John McCain, who sort of spits at the grassroots conservatives, doesn't he?
Sure. I mean, keep in mind that those people would have found their own accommodations anyway, even if Obama beats Hillary, which I think that he will. You know, Obama is no Hillary when it comes to generating Republican loyalty to Republicans. But, you know, most Republicans in the U.S. in the last few cycles, just like most Democrats, end up falling in line for their candidate. But McCain does have a real problem with them in that he's not going to inspire great or above average loyalty among Republicans. Keep in mind, here's a guy who did not win a single primary, if you just measure by people who self-identified as Republicans, until Super Tuesday. He didn't even win. I mean, he tied with Mitt Romney in Florida, and these are even enclosed, you know, Republican-only primaries. But people who identified themselves as Republicans, he never won even a plurality among those people everywhere. There is a discomfort there. They'll come grudgingly, and they'll convince themselves about either the war or about Supreme Court justices. But there's a tangible, palpable lack of excitement there. And in a season in which Republicans are just on the run, in the U.S. right now, it's not a popular party on any level. People are retiring like crazy from Congress. That is going to be a problem for McCain, particularly if it's Obama who wins, like I think he will, instead of Hillary, because everyone can rally around the great demon Hillary. But Obama, people are kind of, you know, even if they disagree with everything about him, they kind of like him.
I just like to remind people that if they have a question about John McCain or a comment, or if they'd like to say anything about politics, please call in at 419-372-8810. That's if you're local. And if you're not, you can call in 1-888-7-WBGU-FM, and we'll pick up the cost of the call. That's toll-free.
And that includes places like Calgary, Alberta. If you're listening from Calgary, Alberta, we are broadcast live on the Western Standard .ca. So if you're listening in Calgary, you can call in too, and you can ask Matt Welch a question. If you're a kind of diehard conservative and you love John McCain, call in and challenge Matt. So Matt, I wanted to ask you actually about his birth, about John McCain's birth. Is there a problem? He was born what, in the Panama Canal? Is that right?
Panama Canal Zone. Yeah, I believe it was his grandfather at the time was stationed there, who was also a four-star admiral in the Navy, and his father decided to come and bring his mother over to have the baby so that the whole family could be united in the same place. There's no problem at all. The New York Times, again, of all papers, decided to sort of make this an issue. And it's been kind of an interesting academic exercise of people going into constitutional law. Basically, you have to be a citizen or a natural citizen of the United States, not naturalized, but a natural-born citizen of the U.S., but the accepted interpretation of this forever has been that everyone who's born on a military base abroad, and I think even you can just be a son or a daughter of a military serviceman anywhere abroad, let alone on a base. You could be on a ship somewhere. You're considered to be a U.S. citizen. And not only that, but I read, I think yesterday, Barack Obama himself.